Hey, welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball. Quick programming note, you should check out the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you download podcasts as well. Sean McCaw is my guest on this pod. Sean was a very good college basketball player at Southern Utah, started his career at Arizona, but maybe more importantly, he's written a book on traveling and playing in Europe, played 13 years overseas, and it's really an informative book. We'll kind of get to his story and what led him to write the book and what he's doing now. It's fantastic. I think you're going to love it. It's upcoming. I'll only say this about Ben Simmons. It does relate to the Kyrie Irving story from this perspective. Ben's saying he's not mentally in the right headspace to play, and Kyrie's saying this is a personal decision. If we judge these things just based upon how it reads, okay, it's hard to push back against somebody mentally not being in the right headspace. It's hard to push back against Kyrie saying, hey, this is my personal decision, even though I think it's silly. You have a job. Once you knew there was the likelihood of having to get vaccinated in order to play in these games. And oh yeah, by the way, the really unselfish thing is to get a vaccination, but I'm not doing a vaccination pod. But the problem with both of these players who are immensely talented is there's other stories that lead you to believe or lead you to not believe whatever they're telling you now. You know, Kyrie has been hurt a bunch, and then he didn't want to play in the bubble. He got hurt last year, didn't play in the playoffs. There's, you know, he's just been a tough one to really wrap your arms around and love, even if you love his talent and the way he plays. Ben Simmons, like, look, if this was really an issue, why was it the one issue in the contract that they can't fine you for? Pretty smart. Didn't show up on time, then shows up without telling anybody, then has the cell phone in his pocket. Again, in and of itself, either of these stories, you know, whether you agree or disagree with them, it's not the worst thing in the world. But when you factor in other issues where they have said something else to try and get out of doing something else for their job, you kind of start to roll your eyes and not really believe the validity of what they're saying. All right, let's get to Sean McCaw, who's an author. He's now a teacher. He's a former coach and a former star playing in Europe.
Okay, so Sean, you're joining us from Germany, where you just had back surgery?
From Germany, yeah.
Is this a basketball injury? Is this years and years of playing hoop with the back, or is something you just did, you know, picking up a box?
It's the wear and tear of being a professional athlete from playing years on the concrete basketball courts in Vegas. It's just the wear and tear of an old guy.
Okay. So growing up though, what was basketball like for you? Who, like, let's go high school AAU team was what team?
I mean, I'm an old guy. So AAU wasn't that popular in Vegas when I was coming out. I went to a lot of the Pump Brothers things, and so my Vegas team was, I think, the Las Vegas Arcs or something like that, and we went to Arizona State, we went to a couple of things in California, and we did some stuff there, but AAU basketball was not the same like it is now back then.
No, but Vegas was still, I mean, I grew up in Southern California, and that's where we went for, you know, the Big Easter tournament. And then, of course, you had the John Farrell National Championship in the summer. And it wasn't just the North and the South gyms. It was all the different high school gyms at the time. So you're playing. And Vegas has become a pretty good wellspring. There's a lot of talent there, not just going to Finley, but kids that live there, right? But your thought in terms of playing in college, what was or playing professionally, like, what was your mentality when you're 15, 16 years old, you're traveling to LA to the Pump Brothers? Like, what were the thoughts in your mind of what you wanted to get out of this game?
Well, at that time I was pretty raw and I didn't have the grand illusion of being a professional basketball player. Of course, every kid wants to, but I think my immediate goal was I wanted to play for UNLV. That was I'm a Vegas kid. What Vegas kid doesn't want to play for the Rebels? So that was probably my initial goal. But so when I graduated in 91, they were under a whole lot of trouble. And so when that dream kind of fell to the wayside, of course, I was getting recruited by some pretty good colleges and ended up going to University of Arizona. But back when I was 15, 16 years old, my goal was to be a running rebel.
Okay, so you go to Arizona. Who recruited you to Arizona?
Coach Olson.
And why did you choose Arizona?
Well, Arizona ended up being the last choice that I had. And I really wanted to wait and see what was going on with UNLV. And then it got to the point where it was like, okay, I'm waiting for so long that other schools are starting to fall off. We had told Boston College no. We had told Laramie State no. We had told a lot of schools no already that was recruiting me. And Coach Olson was still interested. And it was like, okay, this Vegas thing is not going to work. Let's go to Arizona. I was a big fan of Sean Elliott. So that was kind of a draw for me as well. And I went into it a little bit naive, but that was the choice that was supposed to be made for me at that point.
So you show up at Arizona as a freshman. What was it like?
Oh, I was a hot mess, man. I was a hot mess. I was a very confident kid, but I hadn't proven anything. I mean, I'd won a state championship in Vegas the year before, but I was very raw. My college roommate, my freshman year, was Damon Stoudemire. He was very polished. The very first day of practice, I looked at that guy and was like, hey, that's a future pro. He was killing Matt Othick in practice. Me, on the other hand, I was matched up against Chris Mills, who immediately took exception to the high level of trash talking that I was doing as a freshman. And I think it was the first practice of the year he broke my nose with an elbow, a very intentional elbow. But it was basically like, hey, kid, shut up, get in line, wait your turn.
How much did you play?
Oh, man. I was a scrub. I mean, I was getting garbage time. I was the kind of the fan favorite because I would get in and get dunks and stuff like that. And I mean, I'll never forget playing against LSU when Shaq was there on national TV. I played, I think, the last 2.5 minutes. And all my friends and family, they called me after the game. It was like, hey, you only played 2 minutes, you know? So that kind of got to my head a little bit. And that was part of the reason why, what led to my downfall in Arizona. But I played my role until I got unceremoniously kicked off the team. But I wasn't happy there.
I remember that LSU game, right? That was the one in Baton Rouge. That was like
No. This was 91. This was in the McHale Center in our like Christmas tournament or something like that.
Because the year before
was the year that Shaq just dominated them.
Dominated, he was dunking, he was doing the cabbage patch, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned you got kicked off the team. What happened? What really happened?
I was in the doghouse the whole year, man. I was partying, I was having fun, I was living the life of an 18-year-old just away from home for the first time. I was just a hot mess. I was on academic probation. I was just terrible. But then I think it was in January. I was out of the doghouse, and Sean Brooks was really a really good inspiration for me, and he took me under his wing and kind of helped me out a lot. And I was getting out of the doghouse, and for some reason, we went on a road trip to Cal. We were like the Cal-Stanford swing. And in Stanford, we won, I think, at the buzzer or something like that, so it was clear that I didn't get in. Then in Cal, we were blowing them out, and that was usually my time. And the fans that had been traveling with us were calling my name because that was definitely Sean time, you know? And they were chanting my name, but I didn't get in. And Coach Olson came like to the bottom of the bench where I was sitting next to Sean Brooks. And he came over and looked at me, just stood over me and looked at me. And then he put in Ray Owens, who was also a freshman, and he was the same type of player actually as I was. But it was, we kind of had a hierarchy of the guys that played, and it was clearly Damon was 20 minutes a game, right? And then if there was garbage time, it was me and Ray. And he just puts Ray in. I didn't see the floor. So everybody's looking at me like, Sean, what did you do now? I'm like, nothing, I'm good. I didn't do anything. And I didn't play. And I was a hothead back then. So after we get back to Tucson And I think we had practice the next day on Monday. And if you know Tucson, if you know the McHale Center, it's all right on campus, 18,000 seat arena. There's people walking through the campus and walking through the McHale Center to get to class. There's reporters there. So at any given time, there's maybe 100 people roaming around. So we start stretching in midcourt, and Coach Olson walks over to me and says something to me I don't like. I can't remember what it was now, but it was something that to the effect of why I didn't play. And I really took exception to it. And we got into it. And before the guys could cool me down, I was already gone. And Coach says, well, get out of here. Give your stuff to the manager. And don't come back until you think you can be a productive part of this team. My 18-year-old hot-headed self, I'm sure they still tell this story in Tucson in some way, shape, or form. I take off my practice jersey. I take off my Huarache sneakers that we were the test team for the original Huarache basketball shoe. I took off my Huaraches and I threw them at Coach Olson's feet. Now, if you know Coach Olson, if you knew Coach Olson, very businesslike guy, like no nonsense, very clean, very smooth man, very disciplined man. I don't think that particularly went over well with him. And I pretty much strutted out of the McHale Center. I threw them at his feet and I said, you give them to the manager. Not a wise move. I strutted out of there with socks and shorts on. And I never saw that floor again.
Ever.
No.
So did he call you in and say, you're done here? Did he say, we'll try and find another school? Did you work through one of the assistants? Like what happened then?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. My reception went out. What did you say?
So what happened next? Like, how did it, call you in and you sat with him? Did you sit with the assistants? Did they just said, hey, you got to find another school? Like, how did it actually go?
No, the assistants, they talked to me and stuff like that. I kept in touch, but I went back home to Vegas, like right after that happened. I had to borrow $50 from Damon to take a bus ride back to Vegas. Not sure if I even paid him back. I think I did, but I have to ask him the next time I talk to him. But so I took a bus back to Vegas, hid out from my parents, just kind of laid low. My parents didn't know where I was at. I was at a friend's house. And I got in touch with some schools that were recruiting me originally. And one of those schools was New Mexico State. And I think it was McCarthy still at the time that was coaching New Mexico State. He kind of pushed me towards Dixie Junior College, which was in Utah, which was one of the best junior colleges in the nation. And he was like, okay, you've had pretty much a year without playing. Why don't you go to a JC and then we'll recruit you again and then we'll see what happens. So basically that's what happened. And then I came back to Tucson. I went to Coach Olson's office twice to talk to him and see about getting back on the team. And both times, like, we had to make an appointment. You couldn't just walk into Coach Olson's office and say, hey, Coach, I'm here. You had to make an appointment with the secretary. You had to, you know, put in that time. And both appointments, he didn't show up. He wasn't there. So I took that as a sign, like, okay. And it wasn't meant to be. And I just focused on going to school and finished up strong in school. And then I transferred.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Then how'd you end up at Southern Utah?
That was interesting because actually Southern Utah never even recruited me. Southern Utah is, Cedar City is about 50 miles away from Dixie in St. George, Utah. And I was getting hit hard by all the schools that had recruited me. I had a pretty solid season at Dixie. We were a very good team and a lot of D1 talent. So I was getting hit hard. And I was making my official visits. And I think I had one scheduled for Wake Forest, and I had one for New Mexico State, Arizona State, and I think Long Beach State at the time. And I had one trip left that wasn't booked. So a friend of mine played on the football team at Southern Utah. And I went up there for a spring game, for the spring football game. He told me, hey, big party here after the game. Why don't you stay? Me, college student, broke as I don't know what. I didn't have enough money for a hotel. So I ran into Coach Evans. Coach Bill Evans was the coach at the time. And I ran into him at the game. And I said, hey, coach, I've got one official visit left. You give me a hotel room tonight, I'll take my last official visit here. His jaw drops. He pulls out the big, you know, the big Motorola gray cell phone with the black antenna. He makes a couple of phone calls, and then he organizes a hotel for me. And I go to the party, have a great time at the party. Next morning comes the official part. And and I really loved what he had to tell me. I mean, he was also on the fly for him too, because they never recruited me because they thought they had no chance. And the key for me going to Southern Utah was I had a kind of a family in Dixie that kind of took care of me and really helped me out a lot. And the mom, she told me, hey, Sean, there's nothing wrong with being a big fish in a small pond. That phrase was the start of me deciding to go to Southern Utah. And I thought about it the whole night, my last night there. The assistant coach had given me the whole paperwork, the letter of intent in the nice folder and everything, said, yeah, you might want to look in there. The letter of intent is in there. And I called my Utah mom and talked to her at, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I told her I really liked what I saw. And I was afraid to go to another big college and lose 2 more years. And she told me that phrase again. And about an hour later, like 3 o'clock in the morning, I signed the letter of intent. Coach comes knocking on my door early in the morning, go to breakfast. I hand him the envelope or the folder. I say, hey, you might want to look in there now. He looks in, sees it, gives me a big hug, and the rest is history. Hall of Fame.
When you get done playing at Southern Utah, you have a couple really good years, right?
Yeah.
What, how did the process begin, because this is, you know, about your book, in terms of playing overseas?
Well, I had the unluck that, of course, this is 1995. What happened the summer of 1995? NBA goes on lockout. First time ever. So there went the dreams of going NBA route, I was slated to play in the Rocky Mountain Review with the Jazz. I had some scouts looking at me, but I wasn't going to get drafted. I was realistic about that. So I knew it was just going to be a free agent route. But of course, everything goes locked down. No Rocky Mountain Review. Nothing's going on. I had an agent, an Italian agent at the time, Massimo Rizzo, who said, okay, look, well, I can get you a contract in Italy. Got me a deal in Italy. But then they wanted to stall, because they wanted to see how long the lockout would go. Of course, if they can get a fringe NBA guy rather than a unproven college guy, of course. So they kept me on hold for about 2 weeks. And I am a very impatient person by nature. So these 2 weeks go by and it's maddening for me. And I tell my agent, look, get me any job you can get me. I just want to play. I don't care about money. And the money that was being offered from this Italian team was very decent. So I said, hey, look, just give me something. And he tells me, okay, look, this team in Austria. The money is horrible, $1,200 a month. Absolutely peanuts compared to what I would have made in Italy. And he says, they've been calling. They're playing in the European Cup. It was called the Quaritch Cup at the time. Mm-hmm. He's like, you're going to go there. You're going to put up good numbers. And then you're going to play in the European Cup. You're going to put up good numbers, and then it's going to be easy for me to get you a job in Italy or Spain, wherever, the next year. So I said, okay, bet, let's do it. I fly to Austria, don't know where the hell I'm going. I'm thinking I'm playing in Vienna. It's not Vienna where I'm going. It's in Katzenberg, which is a very small town, about 2 hours from Vienna. But everything goes according to plan. I start putting up really good numbers. I'm playing really well. We're winning. We're 11-1. We're playing in the Quaritch Cup. I played good stats in the Quaritch Cup, the games we played. Then comes the moment that changed everything. I broke my leg in a game. And that just changed my whole career and how it went after that. It happens. It's the way it is.
Well, so when you broke your leg, was it like a Paul George thing? Was this just like a stress fracture? Like what
close. Was it? It was what I know now. And back then you have to realize this is the dinosaur age of European basketball. There was the training facilities, the medical facilities, everything was a lot different than it is now. So what actually happened was two weeks prior, in practice, some guys fell on my leg. And I had it. Now I know I had a hairline fracture, but the doctors didn't see it. So I kept playing, kept practicing. We were running up hills. We were running on concrete. It was crazy. And my leg got worse. It was swollen. It was hurting. But of course, as an American, as a foreign player, you don't want to show any signs of weakness. So I just kept pushing through. I said, okay, the doctor tells me I'm good. I'm good. Icing it up. Everything is okay for me. And then, it gets considerably worse over the 2 weeks, but I keep playing. And then we were on a road game and I stole the ball at half court, took my two steps, right, left, jump off my left leg, and it just snaps. And it was basically a compound fracture. It was a pretty bad break. And it changed the trajectory of my career.
Okay. So what happened then?
So you know you've played overseas, you know how it is. You got that contract that says if you are injured for longer than a period of probably 6 to 8 weeks, they put a band-aid on you, they ship you home, especially back then in 1995. So, and this is a small club in Austria, they don't have a lot of money. So I was totally expecting to be on the first thing smoking. After I break my leg, we take the ambulance back to my town, the team doctor operates right away. And the next morning, I'm in the hospital and I'm just devastated. I don't know what's going on. My coach, who was also the son of the president, comes into the hospital room and he says, "Look, we like what you did here. We like you as a person. We're going to offer you a contract for the next season. Same conditions as this season. The only thing is, you have to stay here. You have to rehab. You have to." Stay here the whole year. You have to totally be ready to be fit for the start of next season. So I'm thinking, I'm sitting in the hospital room and I'm thinking, hey, I'm making 1,200 months. I made, so 2 months salary, $2,400. I spent probably about half of that already. If I go home, I have to pay for rehab for myself. I have to pay for doctor bills by myself. And I didn't have that kind of money. So it was easy for me. It was like, hey, give me the contract, sign on the dotted line, I'm back for next year. And I mean, that was a very generous deal from the team. My agent had something to do with that as well. But that was something that you don't hear about regularly in European basketball.
Okay, so how long till you were back?
I started the next season on time. I rehabbed like crazy. It was a crazy situation, but I was back, but I would say I was probably back at about 60% of my normal self. I wasn't totally fit at all. And then I had an up and down season, really poor for an American because I was limping. I lost my explosiveness. And so the coach and the team, I played a horrible season for an American. And I knew it was going to be hard for me to get a job with stats like 15 points a game and coming down to Austria, right? So my agent was also of the same opinion. So they came and they said, hey, look, we see that you're still fighting your injury. We're going to offer you another contract for 2 more years. We'll get you fit, everything. And that's how I ended up staying in Kapfenberg for a total of 4 years before I left and went to another team.
Did you learn the language?
Yes, I speak fluent German.
Did you do that just by, submersion technique, or did you actually take a class or a teacher?
I've never taken a German course in my life. I actually had a lot of downtime after I broke my leg. So I was watching a lot of The Simpsons. I was a huge Simpsons fan. And I knew all the episodes from back home. But in Austria, they have German TV and they don't do subtitles. So I was watching The Simpsons and I knew what they were saying. And that's how I was piecing together how to learn German. And of course, then I had a girlfriend who taught me German, and you just, I'm pretty good with languages. So I was able to pick it up pretty quickly.
Okay. So you're there 4 years.
I'm in that team for 4 years and one more year at another team in Austria.
Okay. When did you leave Austria?
After my fifth season, I got the Austrian citizenship. I changed my citizenship. I'm now an Austrian citizen. I'm no longer an American citizen at all. I don't have dual citizenship at all. That was not allowed. And then it was possible for me to, of course, earn more money as a European player. So for the listeners that don't know, if you have a passport, you are able to play in a European country as a home guy and not as a foreigner. So basically, I could play as an American, but not take an American spot, which made me more valuable. So I went to France.
This is in 2000. You went to France?
Right. I went to France in the second division in France, right outside of Paris, for that first year.
What was the experience of playing in France as opposed to playing in Austria?
Oh, night and day. The league, even though it was second league, was very competitive, very physical. And I guess I wasn't really used to it anymore. And I didn't play the greatest season. Then we ended up going on a losing streak. And because I think I was the highest paid player on the team, I got fired. I got let go. And I went to Portugal to finish the season. I think the last 2 or 3 months of the season.
And what was Portugal like?
Pretty nice. I loved living there. And that led to me then re-signing in Portugal on another team than the one that I ended the previous season with. I played in Cabo Madeira. It's an island, and warm weather, great city, or great little island. And I played there for one season, yeah.
So in total, you played 13 years?
Yep.
Your last season was where?
In Germany.
And with who?
I was in the twilight of my career, and I knew I only had one or two more years left. I only wanted to play basically until I was about 35. That was my vision, because I wanted to start coaching. So I went to a small city called Jena in the east of Germany, and they were in the second league. So I was thinking, okay, 1-2 years maximum, I'm done. And this team we were overachievers. No one expected us to win the promotion to the first league, but we did it. So the team, of course, wanted to keep the team together, and I stayed to the first league season in the Bundesliga, in the top league in Germany. That year was the strangest year of my life as far as my career goes. So we move up into the first league. We had no money. We were by far the lowest budgeted team. We were just kind of happy to be there, kind of. And I knew that was going to be my last season. I was supposed to come onto the coaching staff the next season. This was going to be my last hurrah, one last year, first league, and then I was going to go into coaching. Turns out we stunk, and the team fired the head coach. But before they fired the head coach, they approached me to take over as head coach. So I am a player halfway through the season. We've won two games. And they come and tell me, hey, we want you to take over as coach. I'm like, yeah, what about Bjorn? No, we're going to fire him. I was like, no, not doing it. That's just bad karma right there. No, not doing it. 2 weeks go by. They badger me. I have a conversation with my brother. He says, look, Sean, you want to coach? You can do that with no pressure. Nobody expects you to turn the team around and stay in the first league. You can learn your chops. You have no pressure. Do it. So after I talked to my brother, I changed my mind, and I said, okay. Had my last game in Bonn, and I cried buckets after that game, because I knew that was going to be my last game, and they were going to turn the keys over to me. But no one else really knew. And yeah, and then I went from being a player to the head coach of a first league team in Germany, what I've never heard of ever happening ever in any country. And so we played on a Saturday. Monday morning, I was head coach with the guys I had just played with for a year and a half.
That's crazy.
not the ideal situation. I had 2 weeks before, I'm out drinking with these guys and partying with these guys, and now I'm telling them to do line sprints. Not exactly the best start for my career, but I would do it all the same again because it really showed me that's what I wanted to do.
Did you guys get better or worse with your coaching?
I can say we won 3 games. That was one more than the previous coach had. So for me, it was a success. And we got relegated. We were terrible. We had no.
Did you play or only coach?
Funny you should ask. I have one clip on YouTube. That is me having to sub myself in during a game because we had some injuries towards the end of the year. We had some injuries. We had some suspensions. A guy got caught smoking weed, got kicked off the team. So we only had like 9 players. I had to trade in the suit that I had been wearing the couple of games before. And I had to stand on the sideline in my uniform. And I had to be listed as a player, even though I was the coach. So we had a game against Bremerhaven. And I had to sub myself in because it was foul trouble. I ended up hitting a wild 3-quarter court shot at the buzzer to put us in overtime. And that is my one clip on YouTube.
Mike Dunleavy, I don't know if you remember this, when we were kids, Mike Dunleavy did that. He was the coach of the Bucks.
Yes. Yes,
and they had a bunch of injuries. And so he played one night. That had to be the coolest and weirdest thing. Best city in Austria?
In Austria?
Yeah.
For best basketball or just overall?
No, overall. Give me one place.
Overall, you have to go. Oh, you got to go to Vienna. Vienna's a great city. There's a lot of culture, a lot of older culture, but it's a fantastic city.
Best thing to eat in Austria?
Wow. There's a thing called Fladensuppe. It's a soup. And what you have to imagine, it's like a pancake that they cut into strips and put it in like a beef broth. It's not pancake like syrup or, you know, that's a weird thing to get in your head, but it's actually a really good soup. That's one of my favorite things from Austria.
Best place to go visit. You have to go visit in Germany.
Berlin. Oh, by far, it's probably my favorite European city. I love living in Paris, but Berlin is off the chain.
Best thing to eat in Germany.
You got to get a sausage with sauerkraut and have a big Viking beer.
You mentioned Paris. Coolest place to go and eat in Paris?
Oh, it's been a minute. I think anywhere along Champs-Élysées to just sit out, have a coffee or croissant and just people watch.
That's the ultimate.
Okay.
So you decided to write a book about the entirety of the experience. When did the idea come to your mind?
The idea came probably sometime after I broke my leg and I went through that experience because it wasn't the best experience in total for me. But I've always liked to write, but I never thought about doing anything until years later. I think I was playing in England at the time. And that's when I started. That's probably about 15 years ago, something like maybe a little bit more than 15 years ago. And I actually wrote it then. But I tried to get it published, and back then it was no self-publishing, and I couldn't get it published. It's a niche book. That's okay. But I couldn't get it published back then, so I pretty much just handed it out to people that I thought needed the information. And then in 2020, I had more time on my hands, and I refurbished it, I updated it. My best friend told me, hey, you got to get that out there. There's information in there for people. That can help people. So that's my main goal with this book, is just to help people and help them navigate, especially their first year overseas, because that's a really key to how the rest of your career will go.
So how do you determine who you think should represent you?
As an agent? That's a personal thing. I think I was lucky enough that I had, coming out of college, I had like 8 or 9 agents to choose from, but a lot of guys that play overseas, they don't have that luxury. So they're having to search, actively search for an agent. And I think that's for the majority of guys that are not EuroLeague guys, that are not guys that are going from Duke to Greece or, you know, big time guys, it's hard to find an agent because agents, of course, scout. And if they do not scout you, they probably won't want to hire you. So they want to make money. And if they think you can make the money, then they'll scout you. If not, then you fall through the cracks. So that's why my book was important for me, to get the information out there that people can find their own agent. It's going to take a lot of banging on doors, writing emails, calling, a lot of rejection, but it's possible. And you basically have to find a happy medium between having an agent that you trust and that you actually like. And you really don't know if you have a good agent until one of two things happens. You need a job. So if he can get you a job, but more importantly, if something bad happens, if you break your leg, if you get fired, that's when you know if you've got a good agent or not.
Right. How, then it's easier now, right? Because, I mean, look, we can connect. You're in Germany, right, and the States. You can Netflix, you can Amazon, you can Apple TV, you can do all that stuff. But there still is, you're in a foreign country, and a lot of guys, they think they've been away from home because I went away to school, but it's completely different. In 2021, how do you manage the difference in culture and missing everything that is your normal life?
Well, guys these days have it easy. Like you said, there's Netflix, there is Skype, there is iPhone message, there is, you can FaceTime with people. So it's a lot easier to keep in touch. I remember when I was, my first phone bill when I got to Austria was $650 because I was just constantly on the phone. And so these days it's much easier to stay in contact, but of course you're going to miss home. You're going to miss your family back home. You're going to miss things like that. But these days it's just way easier to keep in touch and to keep some kind of bond than it was in 95 when I came.
You mentioned, and I think this is kind of an interesting part, is you mentioned that your agent convinced you to take less money, not wait on the Italian team, and take no money in Australia to put up numbers. And I actually think that's great advice. There's a limit there, right, to how little you'll play for. How do you balance it? Like, if you were to advise somebody versus, because I think a lot of these guys are like, look, I want to make six figures. I got to be in a big club. Like, my first club was this big club in Russia, and I split time, and then they would do the thing where, and I was playing as an American. So we get a big lead and the Americans would come out. Right. And it because they wanted their guys to play. Yep. And it hurt my numbers. So if I could redo it, Germany would have been great. Like, just play, put up numbers, and grow from there. But how do you balance it? What's the advice on what your first job should be like?
Well, I mean, it all depends a lot on how respected your agent is, how they do business. If you're one of the guys that is a potential EuroLeague player, you have a team of advisors. You have the best of the best working for you. My thing is the guys that don't make the $100,000 a year or $200,000 a year, $300,000 a year, the guys that are making $5,000 a month, the guys that are making $1,200 a month. That's a hard thing. So the guys that are not making a huge amount of money, sometimes they have to take what they can get. It's not, they might not have a lot of choice, and you just have to make the best of the situation. Now, if you are one of those guys that has a high powered agent and you're getting that high powered job, or you have these offers that are coming at you for a lot of money, then it's up to you to figure out what's important to you. And this is where I think today it's much easier than when I was coming out. When I was coming out, I had to look in an, I had to actually go to a library and look in an encyclopedia to find any information about Austria. That's what I did. But it wasn't telling me very much, right? Especially not about basketball. But today these guys can jump online and they can check stats, they can check numbers, they can see how many Americans were there at a team, how many left. You can look on Eurobasket and see why that person left. You can really investigate these teams just as they investigate you. So I think it's important for these guys to really look into the offers, look into the teams, see where they rank, what is your goal? Is your goal only to collect your money, stash it away, or is it to have a long career where maybe you take a step back to have a longer career? It's everybody's individual choice, but I think the most important thing is you definitely have to research these offers, these teams, these coaches, these general managers, and see what's out there online that might be able to help you maneuver through what could be a make or break season.
Last thing. So you, the book comes out, right? It's available and you can get anywhere. Is there anything you felt like, man, I wish I would put this in there?
No, I for the market that I'm trying to get at, I think I got everything in there. This book was so long in the making, and I mean that's why I called.
Yeah, you're talking about when you're talking about when you first broke your leg. That's 25 years ago.
Yeah, right? 25 years ago, and so a lot has changed, but a lot hasn't changed. And that's what really helped me to refurbish it, because there's a lot of things that I have in the book is the same as 1995. There's still disputes about contracts. There's still shady agents. There's still shady teams. There's a lot of things that these first, especially the first year players will have to deal with that I hope that this book can help them with and have in their hands. But from the people that have already read it, even vets have told me, hey, I didn't know that. So there's nothing that I probably would have added. I just wish I had done it sooner. I wish I had really done it sooner.
I think when I think back, it was, you know, especially when you're young, you're not really demanding, you know, you're not, and you're just kind of like, you're just so happy to fat girl at the prom, happy to be there, right? That you're like, oh, you give me a car, whatever. Like, yeah, the car's like, you have a car, it's a piece of shit. I remember when I played in Israel, Corey Carr was my teammate and Corey tore his ACL. So we brought over Adrian Peterson, who's one of my closest friends. I played with him in college. But, you know, because Corey had played there so long, because he was hurt, like didn't have an extra apartment. So I'm like, well, you can stay with me. Right.
Right.
Well, I was like just married. And, you know, my wife, we all went to school together. So it was cool. But then it was like, all right, where are you going to get? We're all just too nice where we should have been like, dude, when he hits the ground, he should have an apartment. He should have
exactly.
A car. Right. But how do you, it's really hard to manage when our culture is different than their culture. You don't know people. You do need yes. an agent that handles all that stuff, but you don't want to be a dick, right? So yes. there's a lot too. It's really hard.
It's a lot to do with being able to adapt to certain situations, but at the same time, not be a pushover. There has to be a healthy balance between yes, I'm excited to be here. I'm willing to be flexible. I'm willing to adapt because Europe is not adapting to you. You have to adapt to Europe. And so I think there's a lot of adaptability, and that's maybe why I had such a long career, because I was able to adapt. But at the same time, you can't be a pushover. If I have to look back to when I broke my leg, I didn't know I could get a second opinion. I didn't know I could the very first time I went to the hospital and they didn't see the hairline fracture, I could have sat for 2 weeks and then I would have been fine. But I didn't know I could go see another doctor. And that's part of the reason why I wrote the book, to explain these things that these young guys need to know.
Hey, you learned the hard way and you want them to
learn the hard easy way.
Problem is that, like, I don't know how many guys you can pick it up and really, really read it. I guess it's on book on tape as well, right? Now, do you have the book on, can you do the Audible thing where you can actually listen to it as well?
Not yet, but that's in
God
the
do it.
I have it as an ebook. It's also as a paperback. I realize it's a niche book. That's not my
it's like a guide, like, you know,
exactly.
And look, the people that listen to this pod, it's a couple hundred thousand people downloaded, but a lot of them are basketball people and college basketball coaches and assistant coaches and high school coaches. Yeah. And all they got to do is say, hey, get this book, download it, read it. Or by the way, listen to it. Even when you're on your way to your first job, you know, these are the things that you should know. You should make. I said last thing, I lied. Best player you ever played against. And I don't have to know who it is, because sometimes you play against, you like, I've never heard of that dude, and he just gave me 30.
What is his name? He went to Texas Tech. I played against him in Germany. I was just talking about him the other day, and now I can't remember his
Sasser?
Name. Yes.
Gerald
yes.
Sasser?
He absolutely destroyed me. I would say that's the only guy where I was literally like, I have no chance against this guy. He just bullied me. The two times we played against him that year when he was in Bamberg and I was in Oldenburg, he just totally destroyed me. And I mean, I played against some really good ones, but that was the one guy where I was just like, nah.
The crazy ones are where you play against a guy who high school, early college, like they were super highly touted. And then you're like, he sucks now. Like, what happened to him? I'm not gonna name names. I was in France. There's the guy who he gave it to me in high school. I'm not gonna lie, he gave me 40 in high school, gave me 40 piece in high school. And he was a 6'5" point guard and he was super highly decorated. And he had a kind of mercurial, but fairly successful like college career. And then I remember like my last gig was on a Pro B team filling in France, Clermont-Ferrand. And we played against, I remember like we watched film and I was like, is that? And I was like, I was watching, he's all right. And then we played against him. I was like, what happened? Well, you ever had one of those where you like the guy was super highly talented? You played me.
Yes.
He good?
Yes. I mean, I played against a former high school. I'm not also not going to name a name, but I played up against
No, you got a name. If you're not in the media, you got a name. You got to tell me who'd you give it to?
No, but he was a highly touted guy, and I played against him in a European Cup game, and he was playing in Peristeria, Athens, and it was just like, wow, this guy played in the league, and he was a little bit older than me. But
Terry, did Terry DeHaere play? I remember Terry DeHaere playing once, and I was like,
what did he play? Seton Hall.
Yeah, he played, but he was like a high first round pick of the Clippers. I remember playing against some overseas, like, wow.
But there's been a couple guys.
A lot of it, honestly, is because guys get to that part of their career and they've played in the NBA and their just heart can't do it. You just can't do it, right? If you played at a big school where it's going to sell out, it's really hard. And then some guys play the big school and play in the NBA. Then you come to some locker room where dudes are smoking outside. And look at your locker and you just, if your heart ain't in it, you just get to the point where like, it doesn't matter how good a player you are. You just heart's on it. So a lot of times it's not even the guy. It's just where they are, the mental space where they are is not healthy.
Exactly.
Being successful.
Exactly.
Okay. So you've coached, you've played, you've written a book. You're not 50 years old and the game has been good to you. You have this long resume. What in 5 years, when I check in with you, what are you going to be doing?
Hopefully I love my job. I'm a educator at a private school here in Germany. And I love my job. I'll be still working there. Hopefully I will have written by then my third book. And hopefully those three books will help athletes.
You teach non-athletes, you teach regular students.
Yes. I teach fifth grade.
10th
These
grade?
Kids have no idea who I was or what I did. They all know I played basketball, but for them, I'm Mr. M, and I'm the greatest thing since peanut butter and jelly.
What subject do you teach?
English.
That's amazing. Yeah. So in your brain, when you think, do you think in German or do you think in English?
Both. My wife is half Greek and half German. Our kids are growing up bilingual. I speak quite a bit of German. We watch TV in German. I watch Netflix in German, because my wife hates to watch English stuff with me because I always correct her. But yeah, I think in both, I also dream in German.
Really?
Yeah. Weird.
Yeah. Squid Game. Is that big in Germany?
Yes.
Do you like it?
Yes. I liked it for the social aspects of the social themes, the gory stuff. Okay. I don't understand why it's
really, I have a 12-year-old son and he's like, and he watched it before I did. And he was like, Dad, you got to watch Squid Game. It's awesome. So I'm watching like, oh my God, my 12-year-old watches it. Like,
yeah, no, the gory stuff is okay, but I love the old man and the whole social theme around him, how we treat old people, how you know, the social aspects of the movie. I really enjoyed the gory stuff, okay, but I don't understand why it's the biggest Netflix show of all time, but okay.
I don't either. It's interesting, right? Like you would have thought whatever the biggest Netflix would have been last year when everybody was locked down. What was lockdown like for you guys?
In Germany, it was strict. It's still strict here. It's still a lot of we have to wear masks a lot. It's still a lot going on. Even in my school, we have to sit in with masks.
What is the feeling like when the story comes to in German TV, like Kyrie Irving, I don't want to do the vax mandate. How does that land in their culture?
It's here because everything has been so strict. I'm European now. I've been in Europe longer than I've lived in America, so I'm pretty much a European guy now. We see things differently, and I just a small take on Kyrie. I think it's everybody's decision. You've got a job. If your job says you have to do it, and you decide not to do it, you have to live with the consequences. And I guess that's what he's ready to do. We'll see how it plays out. But I'm vaccinated myself. But for me, it was a choice, not from my school or my job. It was just I would like to protect other people. But everybody has their own opinion.
But see, I thought that's kind of that's the whole theme that is like. It's the opposite. Kyrie's way of looking at it is, hey, this is about me and my personal freedoms, but you shouldn't call me selfish for it. On the other hand, the whole reason you do it, because he's not going to get sick from COVID, you know, knock on wood, is protecting everybody else and protecting it from metamorphosizing into something far worse, whatever. So I actually think it's counter to his thought. But a part of it is also it's Kyrie, right? He's
different.
He's different, but he's also one of those guys. Like, look, I'm a contrarian by nature, but like that gets to the point you're like, dude, you're just being a contrarian to be a contrarian. And I don't think he has the equity to cash in, you know? Yeah. I think that would be my main issue. If there was one thing you wish you knew, right, when you were coming out of college that you know now, what would it be?
As far as basketball is concerned?
Basketball life.
I would have told my younger self to enjoy the moment of living in Europe a little bit more than I did right at the beginning. I didn't really enjoy it the way I should have until much later, after I changed my citizenship and stuff like that.
That's a good one. Okay, well, we're going to tout the book. I really appreciate you spending some time with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. I appreciate you reaching out to me as well. Like those are the kind of dudes that I relate to. I relate to all your stories. I can't wait to read the book myself and get that.
I'm going to send it to you. You send me your address and I'll send it to you.
Great. I will read it. I got the Patriots book I'm reading. Then I'm going to read that. But
I got you. It doesn't matter.
I really appreciate your time and get that back right.
No problem, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Sean.
No problem.
All right. Thanks, Sean, for joining me. It's Doug Gottlieb here on the All Ball Podcast. Reminder, the Doug Gottlieb Show is daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific on the iHeartRadio app, on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com, or SiriusXM 217 or 203. A reminder, download, rate, review, write a review. Okay, check this thing out. Share it with a friend. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.